This is the official EFL podcast.
Hello again and welcome to the podcast. On this week's edition of the show, we're going to kind of look at things from a different perspective. It's going to be another one of our Legends of the EFL specials, but this time we're chatting to a man who was a former referee in the EFL and the Premier League and has just announced his retirement from being PGMOL National Group Director. That's the body who are in charge of referees, the independent body. The man we're speaking to is Dave Allison. Dave, thanks for joining us. First of all, how does it feel to be approaching retirement for you now?
When you've got probably the best job in the world, i.e. working in football, as I've had for 42 years, although in my early refereeing career, of course, I wasn't actually full-time, but that's another story. The decision is very difficult, but I think sometimes my heart said, why are you finishing? But my body said, listen, you can't keep carrying on at this relentless pace at which you're working, because those who work in football, the managers and the people who play in it, know that it's relentless. It's 24/7, it's 7 days a week. And whilst we all love it, it can take its toll. And I thought, I'll be 71 at the start of next season, and you really can't go on forever. And I wanted to retire on my terms, i.e. when I felt it was ready, rather than somebody saying to me, Dave, you've gone on too long, it's time you retired. That would have been worse. So I made the decision. I gave Mike Riley and the PGMOL a full season's notice, and the EFL as well. So everybody knew it was going to happen. So,
such a distinguished career you've had, of course. Can you remember when you, you know, when you first wanted to become a referee, a match official?
I think nobody wants to be a referee. And I think I've said this before, that I see people walking around the town in football shirts and team shirts. I've never seen anyone in a referee's shirt. I don't think that we set out to be a referee. I think we are all people interested in football, play football. In my case, I played football at a lower amateur level. And we drift into refereeing. In my case, I happened to be injured, wasn't playing on one day, and the referee didn't turn up. It was a local league game in Lancaster. The referee didn't turn up, and they asked me to hobble about in the middle and referee the game, which I did. And I quite enjoyed it, actually. In fact, I got the old jibes from some of my team colleagues who said, you're a better referee than you are a player. And it snowballed from there. I then was at college and university at the time, and they were looking for some referees to referee on the Sunday league. So I began by playing on a Saturday in the local league and refereeing in on a Sunday, and quite enjoyed it. And it all snowballed from there, really.
And take us back. I mean, you started being a match official in the EFL in the 70s, but you became an actual referee in the EFL.
Was it 1980, yeah.
Take us back to the first match.
I went on the line in 1977 after a 10-year apprenticeship coming through the leagues. In those days, it was the leagues such as the Lancashire Combination, the Cheshire League, those leagues. It wasn't quite the Conference and the National League that we now have. It was the various localised leagues. And when I got to the Football League, I started my career on the line at Carlisle United versus Chester City in 1977. Really enjoyed it, was proud to run out at a Football League ground. And 20 years later, when the Football League asked me where I'd like to finish my active career, I said I'd finish it at Carlisle United. So I went full circle.
And very symbolic.
Very symbolic. And my daughter's brought me a little plaque, which is still on my wall at home, and it says, to Carlisle and back, which was rather appropriate, really.
Do you have a lot of sentiment in your career? Have you got a lot of, you know, I imagine obviously you've refereed some high-profile games. Do you keep a lot of memorabilia?
I keep a lot of memorabilia. I think I've got some terrific memories in the game. I loved every minute of it. Football doesn't owe me anything, really. I've loved every minute of it. I think if I look at memorable games, I've refereed the Merseyside Derby. I've refereed the Manchester Derby. I suppose the biggest one would be to referee the Championship playoff final, which in my day was, I think, 40 or 50 million resting on every decision. I think it's probably four times that now that we had this week or this month. But I think the challenges are just the same because the money was relative to the era in which I was refereeing. So it was a terrific occasion. I'll remember forever walking out at the old Wembley, walking up that slope with the ball under my arm and 90,000 people or very nearly so anyway, at the old Wembley. And you can't forget memories like that, really.
And just taking you back as well to that first game in charge, what was it like just as a whole around that period in the 1980s? How did the game compare to what it is now in terms of managing a match? I imagine it was quite different.
It was quite different. And remember that one of the biggest things that I think has improved over my career certainly is the pitches. If I looked at the pitches now, they are carpets and people can play football without the ball bobbling all over. There were moments in my career where the mud was over our boot tops when we were playing, and some of the footballers of the 80s might well remember that. I think football has so much evolved and refereeing has evolved with it. And if I think of the innovations that Mike Riley has put in and the support systems that go with it now with sports scientists, with dietitians, with sports psychologists, we have everything. In my day in the late 70s, early 80s and then the 90s, basically we were on our own. We did training, of course. We went to training sessions and so on at the weekends. But remember that refereeing then was very much a part-time role. I worked in a school as a teacher at the time, and you were having to beg, borrow and steal time off when you wanted to go to Southampton for a night match or wherever, and then drive back through the night and do a day's work. Now, anyone would know that was not good preparation for refereeing a football match, but that's the way it was at the time.
Did it affect you at the time? You've talked about it there, but can you remember games where you thought you weren't on it because of that, or in your professional career as a teacher, can you remember days where you just weren't at it because of the travel, etc.?
Oh, yeah, days when I was a teacher, particularly if I'd got back late at night and the following morning, I certainly wasn't on it in the teaching. Fortunately, I taught a lot of games and PE as well as... believe it or not, most people don't know, but I do. I did actually teach French because I can speak quite fluent French. So that was another side to it. But that gets kept quiet when you're refereeing, really, I suppose. Might be a jibe to get at you, I don't know.
Was it be a real advantage speaking another language?
Well, it was.
In the modern game as well?
It was in the modern game, yes, it certainly was. But I don't think I've answered your question there, have I? But the earlier part of my career... You turned up, you got the fixtures, and you would turn up in your own car. It was up to you to get your own transport there. And you were really almost the match manager now, because not only did we have to go get there early, but we had to inspect the pitch, we had to make sure and do all the things that the Football League, as it then was, not the EFL then, of course, it was the Football League. They wanted us to check everything. You checked the corner flags. You checked that everything was in place. There wasn't so much advertising then, of course. We didn't have as much advertising and certainly not the sponsored shirts in those days. So it was altogether different. And don't forget that TV hadn't really taken a hold of the game in the way it has now. So we weren't national figures. If you were on Match of the Day on the Saturday night or the ITV match on the Sunday, then you were a national figure for a few hours, but every game wasn't televised. So if I went to some games and made an error, unless people bought a pink final or unless people were at the game, they didn't really know about it. Whereas nowadays, the lads are totally exposed because TV has every angle covered, every... highlight every clip, every refereeing error. The game has evolved so much in that way.
How did you deal with it when you knew, like after a game, you had made a major error at the time? Because obviously there wasn't the support network in place as there is now. How did you manage yourself then?
I hated it. I hated making a mistake because the last thing a referee wants to do, you see, people come to watch players play. They don't come to watch referees referee. So if you can be in the background and not affect the result of the game, that is wonderful. Because nobody after the game is going to come and knock on your door and say, referee, I thought you were brilliant today. It's like the same question when people like yourselves ask me, why won't you go out and explain decisions? And the answer I always give is the press and the TV companies only want us to go out and explain decisions when we've got it wrong. You don't want to invite me out and say, well, Dave, I thought you played three brilliant advantages leading to the three goals of the game. I think you've kept the game moving very well. And that's not news, but it is news if I've made an error and I'm supposed to be somehow in half an hour analysing it and looking at why. Now, that isn't possible at a ground, and it wasn't possible in those days because we didn't have any of the clips available at that time. So,
what were the times, though, that you'd want to do that?
I'd love to have done that. No, I don't think so, really, because I think once you try and explain, you're almost trying to justify an error. Sometimes the best explanation is, look, I'm sorry, I got it wrong. I've seen it again. I've had a look at it at several angles. The one thing that always amuses me these days is people say, well, let's have a look at the angle at the back of the goal. When did I have a chance of being at the back of the goal? It can't be on the terraces, can you? So as a referee, you didn't ever have that view. But that's what we live in now. We live in that goldfish bowl, and I understand that, and the referees have to understand that, and the modern referees. But in my day, we could get away with some of those things, I suppose. We didn't have to explain it other than possibly to the managers on the way out. And we would have a reasonable discussion about it. But no one at that point could prove it because every game wasn't fully, televised. So it was always a matter of opinion.
What is the most difficult sort of decision to give as a referee when you don't have the benefit of, obviously, the replays and, you know, the extra officials behind the goal, for example?
You see, I always thought handball was probably one of the more difficult because it's very subjective. The word then used to be intentionally handles the ball. It then moved to deliberately. I'm not quite sure what the difference is between those two words, but somebody no doubt better qualified than me can tell me. There is an expectation on a referee that he's somehow a mind reader. How do I know that you deliberately handle that ball? I don't know. So we try to provide guidelines, but every guideline doesn't fit every situation. No two incidents are the same. No two tackles are the same. No two handballs are the same. So in handball, in a split second, you almost had to judge, is it blasted at him? Could the player get out of the way? Did he move his arm towards the ball? Was it deliberate in that way? And it was such a subjective decision that really I found that probably the most difficult. Actually, people often told me, the ex-players used to say, you never gave handball unless somebody picked the ball up. And they probably were right in a way.
Was that the safest way, do you believe? It's, going for something that looks totally deliberate.
Yes, I suppose I was playing safe.
Yeah, would you favour playing safe?
I would, really, yeah. If I was looking at it, we've tried for many, many years to try and clear up and give clear guidelines on handball, but I'm not sure we've ever achieved that yet.
Is it possible?
Probably not, because it goes back to what I said at the start. You know, it's subjective. You might not think something is handball that I do. You know, you and I would have a look at a situation and we'd probably come up with a different conclusion. that's how it is.
If you look at certain games and certain atmospheres at games, would that ever come into play? Not, obviously, deliberately, but you know, subconsciously.
It's difficult to explain this to people, but when you actually get out there and you blow the whistle, your concentration level as a referee is so intense that you're actually only refereeing Reds versus Blues. You don't actually think it might be Manchester United versus Everton in the middle of the game and who you're giving a decision to. You see a foul by a Red player and you give a free kick to Blue, and so it goes on. Now, people say that if you go to some of the bigger grounds, the Anfields, the Old Traffords, the Newcastles and so on, that the crowd used to suck the ball in. I think as a referee, your concentration is so intense that you blocked that out. You blocked that out and gave what you saw and then coped with the reactions afterwards. Because if you think about it, crowds react to what the referee's given, usually. They don't react first and then we give it. The referee was usually, or is usually, quite quickly giving his decision, and then the crowd will react to it. People won't agree with that because everybody says, oh no, when you get a big home crowd, the referees favour the home crowd. And you can't explain that to anybody who's never done it, I suppose. And that's the difficulty. I was always judged, I felt, by people who couldn't do the job. In other words, plenty of people on the terraces and plenty of people in TV studios and so on. But that is the nature of the beast. And I'm sure there are other jobs like that where people will feel they are judged by people who couldn't do the job.
Of course, there are some critics, pundits, who were harsher than others. Can you just tell us who you looked out for, though, as a pundit when you were taking charge of a match? Whose opinion did you seek, or did you not seek any?
To be honest, I got on pretty well with the pundits. Very few, if ever, let me down on anything that I might have told them after a game. I always thought that people like Martin Tyler were superb with us, in the sense that they have to call it like us. They're commentating on a game of football and they commentate on what they see in a split second. They can then go back to their monitor and say, well, it does look as though maybe that didn't happen. But in the first instance, they're like us. They have to call it. And I had that discussion with Martin Tyler, but there were some great commentators in those days, and I felt they tried to be quite supportive and tried to understand what we were looking at and what angle we had.
Just tell us as well, back in your time, obviously quite a few characters in the game, especially in the 80s and early 90s. Yeah. Who, if you could tell us, who was the most difficult player to manage for you at the time? Who would you think you get their team at the start of the season and you'd look out for them and think, oh, I'm in for a real game today managing, you know, this player?
I think as a referee, you do your homework, but you don't prejudge. So if you don't think that if you're refereeing Everton and Liverpool and maybe Norman Whiteside's on one side and McMahon's on the other, that might not be a flashpoint that you're going to have to monitor very closely, you don't prejudge it. But on the other hand, you're going to have to work possibly harder. One or two players were quite vociferous and you'd work harder with them. I think if you spoke to the old players, they would like to think that I talked to them a lot more, probably a lot more than referees do today. And I understand why not today, because times have changed. And of course, we've got a lot more players who don't perhaps, whose English is not the first language. I could come out with a quip with a player in my day and probably defuse a situation that was going to happen. It's not as easy for the lads these days. They have to do it much more with mannerisms and the hands maybe, and perhaps be a little bit more aloof. And that's sometimes a criticism that's levelled at referees, that they're a bit more aloof. I think they've had to be, in a way. So you always did your homework. There were always tough players. I always liked the players who kick people in front of me and not behind my back. But that's probably making it a bit easier for me. But I always liked to try and get on with them and try and understand what they were doing and try and talk to them. And if we like, I like to think they then respected me towards the end, certainly.
But who specifically would you, can you say that they would try and influence you throughout a game?
I think every player does. I know you're trying to get me to say one or two players. I don't think that would be fair, really. I don't think that's fair, because as a referee, you are neutral. If a referee then came on and said, and it sounds like a politician's answer this, but if a referee came on and said, oh, well, I think player X or player Y was a thorough nuisance on the field, that almost suggests you went onto that field with a prior, you know, idea of something, and that would affect the game. I think you go on with a completely clean sheet. You go on with a completely clean slate. You cannot let a previous match influence you when you go on that field. It's when you feel you've had a bad game at various grounds, and you feel you had, I had unlucky grounds and I felt I had lucky grounds where the game would go okay. And I'm sure players are the same. They're all superstitious. And the Birmingham fans will probably tell me, they probably hated me at Birmingham City because I seemed, for some reason, it never went well when I refereed at Birmingham City. And I don't know why, whether I wasn't on it, whether I made mistakes there. I don't understand why. And yet, I could probably go to somewhere like Carlisle United where it all started, and people used to say, well, you always had a good game when you come here. And I can't work that one out, but it's just the way football is, I suppose.
But managing a game, I'll try and skirt around the question a little bit.
Yeah.
Managing a game when you've got difficult characters, non-difficult characters. I'm thinking, for example, the likes of the Wimbledon Crazy Gang might have been difficult to manage.
They were great. They were great because I could talk to them, and I would talk to them the way they wanted to be talked to by trying to respect them. If you try and talk down to them, you've got a problem. Now, and I know some of the I'd like to think I always got on well with Vinnie Jones and his friends, and I still do. I still see Andy Thorne, who's doing quite a few scouting roles when I'm sat in the stand, and we often chat and have a little, you know, laugh, reminisce of the old days, I suppose. I like to think I got on well with them because you obviously looked at things a bit more closely, but then you've got to be careful because the other team wanted the referee to somehow watch them as though they were going to be the sinners this afternoon and we weren't. Now, that doesn't work in football. Some of those who saying watch them means they're going to be as bad, really. So I always knew which games would be hard. We always studied the team sheets when they came in. We looked at the key clashes, if you like, in midfield. If somebody had a really pacey, tough, a pacey winger that might sprint down the wing and get chopped off at the knees, you might look at something like that. And I think we always prepared for our games in those days. Sounds like I'm ancient, doesn't it?
Well, okay, then I'll phrase it like this, and another sort of question on along those lines. What was more difficult to manage for you, the players themselves or the managers?
Oh, the players, I think, because the managers maybe had a pop at you in the tunnel, maybe were quite vociferous. You know, if I think of Brian Clough, who was brilliant, absolutely brilliant with the referees, you know, he'd you'd think he was going to have a go at you, and yet he'd say things like to his players, you get away from that referee when you've made as few mistakes as he has, you'll be good at your job, and things like that. I mean, he was just a supporter of referees in the way he might have a go at them later on, but he would certainly, to my face, he was brilliant. And a lot of the older managers were too. So the players are always more difficult because you've got not only 22 players on the field, we didn't have as many substitutes in my day, so we didn't quite have 26 on the bench that they have these days. That's another thing. I'm going off at a tangent here, but people say, why do we have a fourth official? Well, in my day, there might have been a couple of subs and maybe a coach and a manager there on the bench. Nowadays, there's 26. That fourth official's got more than I have to cope with. He's got 13 on each bench. So the players, because one man with a whistle if the players don't want to cooperate and the players want to absolutely kick lumps out of one another and not do anything about it and not cooperate with you at all, you'd have anarchy and the game won't exist. So it's managing the players, applying the laws of the game, if you like, in an acceptable way to those players, because good, skillful players want protecting. That's never changed, and it's still the same today. Good, skillful players want protecting. They don't want kicking up in the air. I think what we have done over the last 20 years is probably protected the skillful player more. We outlawed the tackle from behind. We brought in the dogzo, where a player was right through and could be fouled and prevent a clear goal-scoring opportunity. So there are one or two things that have closed the game up, that have made the game more skillful and allowed those skillful players to play. People say there are so many more yellow cards, too many. But a lot of yellow cards are not for the foul itself, not the severity of the foul. They're actually about what it prevents. So if you've got a winger sprinting down the wing with 30 yards of space in front of him and somebody pulls his shirt and stops him from going, that's as bad a foul as somebody chopping him down, really, even though it doesn't injure him. A foul is not about whether you injure the player, it's what it prevents. And I think what has happened over the years is that skillful players have been protected a lot more.
I want to touch on something you mentioned there at the top of that answer with Brian Clough.
Yeah.
I think it was fair to say that he was known, like in the media as well, to be quite protective of referees.
And yeah, he was.
Praise the decisions. Yeah. How helpful was that as a referee? How much confidence did that give you that someone as high profile as that was giving you that support?
Well,
because it's hard to come by, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I used to say I could referee Nottingham Forest from a deck chair in the centre circle because they did behave. It's not a flippant remark, really. But they were one of the easier teams to control. I didn't mean to say they weren't competitive. It didn't mean to say they weren't a terrific side in the day. But they didn't surround you in the way that some other players did. They didn't surround you at that time. And I think perhaps a lot of things that happen on a football field do follow the influence that a manager has. And where a manager is really getting to grips with his players on how they will behave on that field, that probably helps, really. I think if the manager himself is losing his head, that then gets on to the players. And as a referee, you know, when all around are losing theirs, maybe we have to be the calmest person on the field and the calmest person in the stadium sometimes. Because when things are really getting tough and players want to surround, there's little pockets going on here and going on there. I think back to the Battle of Birmingham in 1983, Aston Villa against Birmingham, where you know, people say I refereed that game. I didn't referee the game. I was there. It was all happening behind my back. I didn't get to grips with it. I look at that game and I analysed that game from start to finish. It was on TV. I analysed the game from start to finish, and I like to think I became a better referee as that game. But that was my watershed, because I had an awful game. I was naive. I couldn't see it all happening. I couldn't see it all bubbling up. And I learned more from that game, having had an awful game, than, you know. And I always remember the people at Aston Villa. I'd sat in the dressing room virtually with my head in my hands afterwards, thinking, how have I let that game get to such a bad situation? And people came in and said, no, cheer up, ref, you'll get some postponements. I thought, oh, thank you. Yeah, that's really cheered me up. It was a game that made me look at my own refereeing, made me look at my own tolerance level, made me look at the positions I was getting into and to improve the game. Otherwise, if I'd carried on like that, I might have been in difficulty of losing my place. and you and I wouldn't be having this conversation probably because I'd have gone years ago.
Does going through matches like that, games like that, does that, in terms of your enjoyment of doing what you do, are the times like that, I imagine, are very hard. Some people might quit in that, in those situations, I suppose.
Yeah, they do. You have to be resilient and extremely resilient. Now, our referees today have to be that as well. And we work very carefully with our sports psychologists to, and we talk about parking those decisions and trying to move on into your next game with a clean sheet. That doesn't mean to say that you've not analysed everything, because from whatever game you do, there is always something I was able to do better. There was always something I could pinpoint in a game and say, no, I should have done that better. Look at your body language. You know, maybe I was remonstrating with a player and my body language is as angry as the player. Well, where is that going to lead to? That isn't going to lead to anything other than a confrontation. So you then look at that body language and think, I've got to be much more calm. I've got to be really, I've got to diffuse the situation, not be part of the cause of it. And you always analyse games like that. People perhaps don't think referees do, but we did. And I used to hate it driving home some 3 hours if I felt I'd had a bad game. And then you'd listen to the old sports report or whatever it was on TV, on the radio, on your way home, and 6:06 would be battering you. And you've got to be quite resilient in those situations. I think the worst time for a referee is not when you reach the Football League. You're probably not going to pack up when you've got that far. The biggest danger is in the first 2 or 3 years when you're on the local parks on your own, sometimes in junior games where you're being abused by the parents and whoever else is there. And, of course, you've no protection there because there aren't stewards, there aren't police to help you out. I used to say I'd had that many police escorts in my time, I was glad to be anywhere, you know, because we did. We got that sort of protection. But when you're on the lower leagues, you don't have that. And that's the danger period for a referee, because he will have a couple of years and then think, I can do without this on a Saturday afternoon. And then we lose referees at quite a high rate at that level, which hasn't really changed over the years. We're working very hard at it, but it hasn't. You know, it's still a difficult job, I suppose.
I imagine as well it's a very lonely job, especially in your era at times as well, when there wasn't that support there, was there? And no. I imagine after a match as well, where you mentioned there driving home 3 hours at a time.
Yeah.
A very lonely time.
Yeah, it was. I used to take a friend or two with me, you know, and then they would tell me in the car on the way home, they would go and sit in the stand, watch the game, and they would tell me how it looked. And they might say, you know, you never really got a grip of the number 10 who seemed to be running the game, or they'd do this, that and the other. And they'd give me little tips, which was good.
Did players run the game at times?
You like to think they didn't, but we've all been in that game where you've felt that one particular player might be running at you, giving you advice, and you're not really getting to grips with it and taking him on wide and say, listen, I'll referee the game, you play, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, you can say the wrong thing at times. I've said the wrong thing many a time in a game. You know, I remember saying to a player, who's refereeing this game? And he said, neither of us at the moment. So, you know, you think, well, I asked for that, didn't I? Who's refereeing this game? You shouldn't ask that question. You just say, I'm refereeing this game, you're playing. There's no comeback to that. And it's how you talk, again, it's being forceful, but trying to talk in a sensible manner.
Did you feel in your era that you had to sort of be a bit of a character as well to be a referee, to connect with the players?
Obviously, yeah, I think you did.
Earlier, nowadays, you can't really do that with the fact that there's such an influx of foreign players in the game.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more difficult for them. I think they still have to get on with the players. Of course they do. But I think you had to. Some referees, you see, in my day, they had a presence. They were 6'2" or whatever, and you've already got that presence above the the taller referees automatically have a presence when they walk on the field. You know, when you're 5 foot nothing like me or 5 foot eight like me, you somehow have to earn that. And I tried to earn that by talking to the players, by, you know, forever being a little bit more demonstrative, maybe my movement around the field. I didn't quite have that presence and I had to earn that presence. And there were, if you think back to some of the smaller referees of my era, like Joe Worrell, that was the way we had to work, really. The taller referees that already had a presence, like your Jack Taylors, they would just walk on the field and they had a presence automatically. Some of us had to find our own way of getting that presence, you know. It's up to others to judge that, whether I did or not.
But I'm sure you did have a presence. Just tell us as well, if you look back at your career officiating, what would you say was the best match you ever officiated on? Obviously, you know, you mentioned the championship playoff final being the biggest, but what would you say was the best?
I still think that was arguably one of the best, to be honest, because of the tension surrounding it. It went to extra time, and then we got to the end of extra time, almost, and there was an injury. And while the stoppage of play with about 12 or 15 seconds to go, something like that, Martin O'Neill subbed his goalkeeper because he had a very tall goalkeeper who was good at saving penalties, so everybody was ready for the penalties. And I think it was Stuart Parker was going to take the free kick, I think, and he said to me, how long to go? And I said, 15 seconds. He said, well, I better put it in the box and see what happens. So he did that, and Claridge connected and smashed it into the top corner. I said he shinned it, and he denies that, but that's fair enough. He scored the winner. And the unbelievable explosion of joy from those Leicester City fans was something I'll remember for the rest of my life. They all raced off to the corner flag, and they got in a pile, and there's me trying to tell them, look, can you get up, get in the other half, let's kick off, and you're in the Premier League, is virtually what I told them, because it seemed an age before I could get the game going. And then people said afterwards, well, why didn't you play another minute? Because it took them a minute to celebrate. So Crystal Palace should have had another minute to score the goal. I said, no, they shouldn't. There was only 15 seconds to go when the ball went in the box and the ball hit the net, and there may have been, on my watch, 3 or 4 seconds left, and it was in the net. So time's up then. But I had the thought of saying, if I blow my final whistle now, nobody knows whether the goal's been given. Nobody knows clearly whether I'm disallowing the goal or whether I've abandoned the game or what I've done. So I wanted to get the ball back onto the centre, kick off, and then let everybody know that the game had been finished. It was an exciting game because it ebbed and flowed. Both teams had chances. Crystal Palace got ahead at first. And I enjoyed it, really. I really enjoyed the game as well. Felt I got on with the players. Some of the players now are managers, of course. People like Chris Powell was playing in that game. Get on very well with Chris. And there are a number of managers now. When you asked me before how I get on with the managers in this current role, I like to think I've got on the managers pretty well, because in the current role, most of those were players when I was refereeing. So that's helped as well.
I suppose with referees, they all tend to retire at the top. It's not like players who can... You tend to be your peak at the end of your career, if you know
what
I mean.
Yeah, we didn't have a choice, you see, in those days. When I retired in 1997, there was an age limit of 48. And it didn't matter whether you were fit or whether you weren't or whatever. Once you reached 48, you had to retire. There was an age limit. Now, that was challenged under the age legislation laws. And subsequently, as long as the referees can pass the quite strenuous fitness test at the start of each season, then there's no reason why they can't carry on. So there isn't an age limit now. So I always knew I would have to retire at 48. So it wasn't a decision I made. That was a decision the authorities made, that at 48 we had to retire. So I never had that decision. I've had more of a decision. Now I've chosen to retire from the director of referees role here at the EFL because, I don't know, maybe they wouldn't have let me carry on much longer, but at least I was able to make that decision.
In your time, who did you look at and think was the referee to sort of look out for, in the sense, you know, we, for example, Kalina is well-renowned referee. Who is the one that you'd look out for and think, I could learn something from him? He's the one that's
I used to learn from people like Jack Taylor, who was coming towards the end of his career, people who'd just done the 74 World Cup final, of course, Jack Taylor. People like George Courtney were a colossus in those days. And David Richardson, another FIFA referee. Neil Midgley, who everybody says had a laugh with on the field, but Neil Midgley was a terrific referee as well. And he could diffuse a difficult situation with a clip. He had that great ability. I think I used to take something from all of them, really, like to create a presence like Jack Taylor, look at the movement of people like George Courtney, and movement of referees has changed so much now. I can look back at some of my, and they're not even DVDs, mine. I think they're the old videos. I haven't got anywhere to play them now. And I used to look at the movement now, and we used to run where we think we were getting the best angles, but the science of it all has moved on so much now that if I showed the modern day referee some of my movement, they'd say, what are you standing there for? What are you moving there for? Why have you not squeezed on there? So everything changes. It's like players, isn't it? People often said to me, oh, well, yes, but some of the George Bests and the Tom Finneys, they wouldn't have been as good in today's game. I think that's nonsense because they would have been coached into today's game. I would like to think that if there'd have been professional referees in my day, I would have been one of them. I was one of the first ones, well, the first batch that was on the Premier League in its inauguration in 1992. So I was on that. And I like to think that I would have been one of the professional referees. But you are a product of your own era, aren't you? Players I see now, older players, probably see the way the game has moved and the fact that most of the players can be millionaires at the top and they were playing for what they played for.
How much did the game change, though, when you started officiating in the 70s to the end of your career? Just explain.
Immensely. The speed of the game, the intensity of the game.
And could you feel it on the pitch as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I can see that now as well with the current referees and what we're working with, because the speed of the game is just phenomenal now. The athleticism of the players, and we've had to match that as referees. We've had to work very, very hard with our sports scientists to get our referees into the right athleticism that can cope with the modern game and can cope with the speed of it. I said earlier on, the biggest thing I think is the pitches. I think pitches now, well, you don't see muddy shorts anymore, do you? Unless you go to a non-league ground away in the cup or something. You don't see that now. So the intensity, I think the emergence of television and what it's done for football. I mean, I operated in an era one season where we had a blackout of television. I think it was about 84 or 85. And there was a dispute between the Football League and its clubs and the TV companies. And there was a blackout. We didn't have any TV football for half a season, I think, as long as my mind isn't playing tricks there. But I remember a TV blackout. Now, you can't contemplate that now. You cannot contemplate it. You know, we've got 24-hour rolling news. We've got 24-hour rolling sports channels. Most of it, a lot of it is on football anyway. I know that the other sports have benefited as well, but it's grown and grown, and players now have sports scientists, the technology that's come into the game, monitoring their movement, monitoring with heart monitors. Everything that's gone into that has made the game so much more skillful, so much better. But it is a global product now. It probably wasn't, it was when we had a World Cup final, but it wasn't daily global, if you like, when I was refereeing.
Just tell me about the time between when you retired from being a referee to your role going into the PGMOL. Well, just explain how that first of all came about.
Yeah, that first of all came because when I was retiring, they were looking for people to go part-time as a divisional manager or a referee coach. In other words, they felt that there was the EFL as it then was, the Football League as it then was, felt there was a gulf between referees and players and clubs. It was us and them. To some extent, I can see how that occurred. What they wanted was they employed about seven of us as divisional, we were known as divisional managers and referee coaches, which meant that we had about seven referees, which we watched throughout the season and tried to coach and you know, go through matches with them. I would attend the matches, have a debrief with them, talk to them. But also I was a little link with the clubs so that we then, if the manager had a query, I'd said to them, look, don't go and blast the referee all over the press. Don't go and blast something on the TV where you then get in trouble and you're before the FA. Give me a ring and we'll talk about it in a sensible manner. Sometimes that meant I got an ear bashing, but I didn't mind that because I think we were trying to see each other's point of view better, and I like to think we've developed that over the years. So I did that for about maybe 6 or 7 years, and then I was asked to be a coach with the Premier League for about 3 years. So I coached some of the Premier League referees, and then the job came up here as the director of referees, or the referee manager if you like, for all the Football League. I didn't think at the time that that was for me, and other people persuaded me and said, look, I think you need to apply for that job because I think, you know, you could do it. And it's up to others to decide whether I've done a good job or not. But I think it was one of the best things I did, because I have to say that the heart and soul of football is in the EFL. It's still here. It's people, in some cases, running football clubs with difficulties. You've got local people doing the best to run a football club, and it's expensive these days, and competing with one league, which I suppose gets all the attention and probably most of the money. Well, not probably, most of the money. And that makes difficulties further down. But I like the people. There's nobody full of their own importance in the football, in the EFL. Nobody full of their own importance. And I think that's a quality which in football we should applaud, really. Nobody's bigger than this game.
Going back to your role itself, can you just explain, first of all, now, for those who don't know, what the PGMOL actually is?
The PGMOL, it stands for the Professional Game Match Officials Limited. In other words, in 2001, it was felt that refereeing should be independent of all the leagues, because if you're not careful, if leagues put pressure on referees, therein lies ruin, yeah? The integrity of the game is paramount. And so to have leagues deciding which referee should go on which game, or which there is vested interest in there, that is dangerous. If you take refereeing away from the leagues, in other words, the EFL, the Premier League and the FA, because they want their competitions refereed, of course. So as a little body, and I say little, we've now got expanded actually to about 51 employees, which is includes all the sports scientists, the sports psychologists, the analysts we have, and so on, as well as the staff that do the day-to-day stuff. We have all the appointment of referees to do. We have to be really skillful in who we appoint to which game. There are all sorts that come into that factor. For example, sometimes people say, well, why couldn't referee X do that? He's a good referee. Well, he might have refereed that club a fortnight ago. Or if referees, and this is something the public doesn't always know, have to declare anything that might be a skeleton in the cupboard, for example, if their father's been a season ticket holder of some club, or their sister has a season ticket, or if they've ever played, even as a trial for an under-12 team on one of the clubs, they have to declare everything where they might be excluded from a club. If they supported that club as a boy, they also declare that. That means they're not eligible to referee certain clubs. If you live in that town, even though you might not be from that town, you don't referee that particular club. So if you live in the northeast, nearly always you can't referee Newcastle and Sunderland. You might just be able to referee Middlesbrough, but and so on and so forth. Then you might have a situation where there has been a referee who's had a really serious incident at a game. Maybe the manager's been sent away and then it becomes an FA disciplinary case. We wouldn't want to put that referee back into that club for maybe 6-12 months because it's too fresh and opinions are high. We want to start, you know, if you think when I went back, we want to start with a clean sheet. If you send somebody back too quickly, you don't start with a clean sheet. Now, that doesn't mean to say it always works because sometimes you have to send a referee back 4 or 5 weeks. Now, just because he's given a penalty against that team that we think is a penalty and the club doesn't, that's not a reason not to let that referee go back. And so there are all those things that come into it. Referees are in form, referees are out of form. Some referees lose confidence, like players. You know, a player hasn't scored for 23 games, people start worrying about him. It's the same with referees in the sense that if they've had a couple of what we call key match decision errors, because believe it or not, we stand or fall on our key match decisions. People will forgive us the odd goal kick that we got wrong or the odd throw in on the halfway line that we got wrong. People will forgive us that. They won't forgive us the key match decisions, penalties, goals, major offsides that lead to goals. We stand or fall by those. I have almost forgotten what your question was now.
I mean, of course, though, the scrutiny is increased massively as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
The referees
yeah.
nowadays. I imagine that that's a big part of what the PGMOL actually does. It is the support of referees in those.
It's absolutely
situations.
That we are designed to give referees that support away from the leagues, so with no influence of the leagues. And for example, you know, if you look at my time here, Dave Cookson or Andy Williamson or Sean Harvey have had no influence on any referee at any time. They've been very supportive. They might ask me after the appointments have gone out who's refereeing this club or that club, but they've never tried to interfere. And that is what PGMOL was really founded for. It was to stop the leagues trying to interfere in matters of refereeing. And for obvious reasons, really, you can see if there's too much interference, that leads to a doubt about integrity, which, of course, we don't want. For me, the whole thing in this job, moving up through a coach and taking this job as the director of referees, is that integrity is paramount. And I think if you talk to some of the managers today, even if I didn't always agree with them, I'd always be honest with them. And if we got it wrong, I'd say so. I would say, yeah, we cocked up there. It's an error. It's a bad error. And I can't understand why we've made that error, but I'll be working all week to make, you know, to find out what happened. And I always say to managers, you know, I'm like them in a way. They train all week, they prepare their players all week, and then if the centre half heads it in his own net after 10 minutes, he hasn't prepared for that. He didn't prepare for that all week. So suddenly things have changed. Now, similarly, we prepare as referees all week, and then one of my referees makes an error, a large error. We didn't prepare for that, but we're in the same boat. We then have to react to that and move on.
Just explain that process, though, how it happens. If a referee gets a big decision wrong in terms of the support and review process as well.
Well, the referee, for a start, is going to be worrying about it all week because, firstly, he'll be marked down by the match observer or the evaluator. Secondly, he'll be marked down by the clubs because, don't forget, the clubs have a 50% say in the EFL, a 50% say in the referees. They mark referees on each game and they have their say on any key match decisions. They can ask about key match decisions and I will give them feedback through my team. I don't do it all myself because obviously with 72 clubs, if all 72 on a Monday morning want feedback, so I do have a team who send that back, but they will talk to me about it first and we do go through that way. So the referee is then supported by his coach. We look at the decision that's been made. And when I say supported, there is a myth out there amongst people that referees are right when they're wrong. They're not. And they suffer in the sense of the appointments they get. If somebody's made two key match incident errors in a game, he's not going to get the top match of the day the following week. He may be fourth official the following week because that's not a punishment, but that's going to work with another referee and looking at how that referee prepares for the game, being part of his team and really trying to have input into that game. So there's a support mechanism there. And yet the public and the press say, oh, referee X has been dropped. We don't drop anybody in that sense. We try and support them by taking them out for a week, if you like, to let them get the confidence back while we work on that. And that's how that really happens. But we can then work with the sports psychologists. They work very hard at how we can try and park the decision. You know, analyse it, yes. Learn from it what we can do better. Now, when we go out on the next game, we can't be thinking about that. The other thing is, in a game, it's amazing how they will know if they've made an error. You can give something after 10 minutes, and then when you're walking up the tunnel at half-time, there'll always be some TV man, anchor man, analyst, who will say, you've got that wrong, ref, we've had a look at it. Now, when you know that, you go in the dressing room and you've got to come out and referee the second half. Now, I've had that where they've told me at half time, I've got it wrong. So we have to deal with that then. We then say to the assistants, right, that's gone. We can't worry about that now because if we've got that on our mind, we'll worry about it after the game and we'll try and analyse it and get better after the game. But we can't allow that to affect the second half. And so that's really, you know, I can remember being told on numerous occasions like that, and you had to block it out until at least after the game. You'd then walk to the middle with the ball, and the forward who was about to take the kickoff would say, you know, you got that wrong, ref, meaning, so are you going to even it up? But referees, there is a myth again there that says referees even things up. They don't go out, oh, I better even it up. We don't go out with that because then you've got two wrongs, haven't you? You try and
not
do something.
Not even subconsciously, though? In those
no, not in subconsciously, no. I think you give what you see. You have to trust what you see and give what you see. And some things, you know, you have to be careful about how you interpret the laws of the game sometimes because it doesn't always fit. Now, I get letters where, for example, there have been two goalkeepers played in a yellow shirt. Now, the laws of the game say that there should be different coloured shirts, should be five colours on the field, the two teams, the referee and the two goalkeepers, five colours. Now, if you arrive at a ground and the away team has brought one goalkeeper's shirt and the kit man has packed the wrong one through an error of his own or whatever, we've now reached the best part of 1:30 before a game at 3:00 where 30,000 people are coming. Now, as a referee, would you say, right, we apply the laws of the game, you haven't got the right shirt, the game's off, and send 30,000 people home? Well, that doesn't make sense, does it? So we get on with it, and then the club, of course, gets reported afterwards, and the EFL will deal with it through their disciplinary measures. But the key thing is we have to use a little bit of common sense with the odd law like that so that you can get the game going and get the game ahead.
I imagine postponements are one of the more difficult challenges nowadays in terms of referees for them to actually decide whether a game goes ahead or not. I imagine that's a lot of pressure for them as well because there's so many people going to the matches.
It is. And you asked me before about the worst decisions to make, and I said handball. I suppose if we haven't even kicked a ball, it's whether we're going to play or not. Now, I went to a number of grounds where it was touch and go, but you have to do your research. A groundsman once told me that unless it gets up to 5 or 6 degrees, it won't melt frost. So you would get clubs who were desperate to get the game on for cash flow and everything else, and they would say, it's going up to 3 degrees, ref. It'll melt this afternoon. It's forecast good. And the place is like a schoolyard. You've got to call it off. And it's the later you call it off, the more inconvenience you cause. A way, you know, I used to ask, and we still encourage referees, what time are the visiting fans leaving? Now, I know fans think we disregard them, but we don't. We say, what time are your fans leaving? And if it's 9:00, sometimes you have to make a judgment call and think this pitch will not be ready for 3. But then occasionally, it's not quite like that. There is a thorn and you think that by 3:00, there's a chance. And you'll keep it on and keep it on. And then something happens beyond our control. We have a deluge at 2:00 and the game's off. And then people say, well, it should have been put off at 9. And it's a delicate balance. We can't have it both ways, can we? But we do try to sometimes err on the side of safety, call it off earlier. And then you'll get people saying, ridiculous calling that game off, because if I was out at 3:00 in the centre circle, the pitch was perfect. And it's never easy. So
I do imagine that it's incredibly difficult. One of the... obviously, the innovations of recent years is the use of technology we've seen in the Championship with the use of goal line technology and in the Carabao Cup.
Yep.
VAR being used as well. What's your view on that going forward in terms of, you know,
embrace it.
Referees?
Embrace it. You can't turn back the tide. It's not going to go away. The technology is there. For years, we as a sport, football, were criticised for not being like cricket, tennis. Every other sport had gone ahead of us in the use of technology. They said, why has football got its head in the sand? So now we've gone for it. I think goal line technology, the goal decision system, has been terrific. Can you remember when we last had an argument about a goal or no goal in the Premier League or the Championship? No. We do in Leagues 1 and 2 because we haven't got it. Now, I understand the finances that are involved there, and that's why we haven't got it, because it is expensive. Now, whether that'll ever be addressed, I don't know, but it's something I think is proven proven that it works, and I think in the professional game, we should go for that. Look at the technology we've now got between referees and his assistants and the fourth official. We can all talk to each other. We can all help each other and work as a team. All right, we worked as a team without, but we couldn't. We had to go and talk to the guy across at the field, didn't we? And so on. Now, so many decisions are made without the referee consulting the assistant because he can talk to him. So that's been an excellent addition, and we've got that right throughout the league. We've got it in the National League as well. So that's filtering further and further down. VAR is in its infancy. It'll be there in the Premier League. I think as long as we don't interfere too much, and I think there are, and I'm not going to get involved in politics here, but there are competitions around the world where I think they are getting too involved. And remember, the bottom line was, is it a clear and obvious error? Can we correct the clear and obvious errors? That's what it was brought in for. And I think matters of fact like offside, good. Red cards, good. But I'm not so sure that at times we shouldn't just be saying, well, don't get involved there. That's like the referee's call. A bit like cricket does. When it's shaving the leg stump, they go with umpire's call, don't they? Now, you could argue it might have hit the leg stump, it might not. And so on. And I think we, if it's used properly, I think it will be really helpful. And I think it will leave that injustice that some teams feel when they've got a bad decision with the human eye.
But do you believe it, in a way, some, especially VAR, if we look at, obviously, we saw recently with England women and Cameroon.
Yeah.
We saw the issues we had there. Is that just a case of us ironing out the problems, or is that something that needs to be looked at?
I think really, in that case, it looks at, you've got to look at the manager of that particular side, because it was clear cut the VAR was correct on those two decisions. So there was nothing to argue about. I can't speak for the way the particular manager runs his team, but whenever you get a team refusing to do something on a football field, then we've got anarchy, haven't we? And that can't happen and shouldn't happen, really. I think from the point of view of VAR, it will improve the game, because I think it will clear out those obvious decisions. People say it takes too long. I go to games every week and every Tuesday night and every other night that I can go to a game, and I see a goal scored and we take sometimes a minute to 90 seconds before we kick off again, because we run to the corner, we dive on each other, we make a pile, then we run round with the crowd, and then we do all everything that goes with that, and it's a minute and a half. But we all accept that. Everyone says that's fine. It's a goal. Good. And then we take 40 seconds over a VAR and they say it takes too long. Well, I don't buy that at all. I might be getting political here, but I don't agree that we should go across and look at the screen if I wanted to be critical of it. Why would you? If you trust your VAR man upstairs, why are you looking at a screen? Because once you send that referee to the screen, you're saying to him or her, you've got it wrong. Aren't you? That's what you're saying. You're not going to say, go and have a look at the screen because I think you're right. Because if you're the VAR lad upstairs, you go, alas, you're going to say, you've got it right. Check complete, aren't you? Move on. Let's carry on with the game. So you only send him across when you know he's got it wrong. It's a bit like the press. You only want to speak to a referee when you... So that's the one thing I would improve. But then I'm not in charge of it, so... It's probably, people will probably listen to this and say, good job and all. But anyway.
And what have you made of the recent rule changes, though, that we've seen? And how do referees manage those rule changes? Obviously, we've seen issues with goalkeepers coming off the line for penalties. Is that Is that just like, again, is it an ironing out process of...
You mean the VAR's been used for that?
Yeah.
I don't think it was ever intended for that, to be honest, because I think those are... You know, we don't use VAR for a goal kick, do we, or a corner kick. We don't use VAR for that. So I would say, why are we using it for a goalkeeper on his line? That's all. Let the referee deal with that. For me, whether that's a personal opinion, not a PGMOL necessarily opinion, or FIFA opinion, should I say.
We'll say personal.
Yeah, we'll say personal. I mean, for me, I think you leave the referee to that. Like, you leave the referee to the goal kick, corner kick. Fine.
Just coming back to you now as well, how much pride did you have this season? You know, your final season, you know, fully at the EFL and PGMOL. When you heard the news that you were going to get that contribution to the league award this year, I mean, I imagine that was a proud moment for you, not just you, you and your family.
I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. I've been to those functions, those sorts of awards for other people, really. I look round the room, people who I've looked up to all my life and icons of the game, and I think, wow, I really did. I hadn't a clue. I know the EFL had worked in the background with Sheila and my daughters, and I know that, and they kept it secret. They even went down on different trains, so I didn't even know they were in town. So it was a huge shock, a wonderful moment. Very proud of what other people thought I'd have achieved, really. I think that's the way I've got to look at it, because I just feel I did what I thought was right, and I've done what I thought was right. I feel that I've had a great support from other people. I've had a great support from Sheila and the family and right throughout. And, of course, the people in the PGMOL. You know, without Mike Riley's vision of moving the organisation on, moving refereeing forward, moving refereeing into the 21st century to cope with the modern game has been unbelievable. All I've done is really followed that lead and tried to bring that in at the level I've been working at. It was a wonderful moment. I felt very humbled that in the presence of such distinguished football people that I could get that award. I just didn't see it coming.
Was one of the best things about it having the respect of the people there, the people involved, you know, to that high degree? Because obviously so many people can be considered for an award like that. To be even among those names must have been something that was so magical, as you know now.
It was. I just didn't see it coming. I did not think for one second that I would be considered for an award like that. I really didn't. And anyone who sees the film of my reaction, I'm not a guy who swears very often, but I did then because it was such a shock. And I'll remember that for the rest of my life, I think. And then when Colin Murray said to me, "Who would you like to present it?" And I said, "Well, I didn't know I was getting it, so I haven't had time to think about it." And he just said, "How about your family?" And they came on. Well, you know, my daughters, granddaughters and their wives and partners, and it was just brilliant. So,
And finally, just tell us, you're going into semi-retirement now, but just tell us what you'll be doing next season now.
I'm going to be in the background, and I want to work as... Mike Riley has offered me the chance to work as a development coach. He said they didn't want to lose my expertise altogether. So I'm going to work with referees who maybe I can follow the odd referee or two for three or four games and do some really extensive coaching trying to help that referee through doesn't necessarily need to be in the EFL all the time. I may go lower down if there are some young referees coming through that I can scout. You know, football clubs have scouts. Referees have never had scouts before, really, have they? So I'm almost going to be doing a similar role to that, but it's entitled the development coach, if you like. And that will keep me about the grounds on a Saturday and a Tuesday and a Wednesday and generally trying to help those referees. So it will mean I can slow down a bit. It'll mean I can, I think I said at the time that for 42 years I've never had the ability to say no. Now I can just say, no, I can't do that because I'm going to do something else a little bit. But it's just time to slow down, really.
Well, Dave, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. And it's been fascinating. And once again, thank you for your time.
Thank you for asking me. I just hope I haven't bored you all. Anyway, thanks very much.
Stuff. Thank you very much.
The official EFL podcast. The best reaction to all the match action. Available every week.